It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The U.S. Census Bureau announced it won't deliver redistricting data to all states until the end of September. This means Pennsylvania will be more than 5 months behind schedule on redrawing political maps. Marie Albiges wrote about this delay for Spotlight PA and VoteBeat. Marie, welcome to the Confluence.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Marie, this is a once-in-a-decade redrawing of both U.S. House districts as well as the State House and Senate districts. A five-member commission draws one map. Remind us how those five are appointed.
Sure. So the Legislative Reapportionment Commission, per the Pennsylvania Constitution, is made up of the majority and minority leaders in the House and the Senate. So Democrats and Republicans each have one representative. And then what normally is supposed to happen is the four members pick or select their fifth member. Now, in pretty much every decade that this has been in place, they cannot agree on that fifth member who is chair of the commission. Mm-hmm. And so that responsibility goes to the state Supreme Court, which this time around it has a Democratic majority. So what we're probably looking at is that fifth member being a partisan Democrat, which would give the commission that draws the legislative maps a 3-2 Democratic majority.
Right. And 10 years ago, it was the reverse, 2-2, obviously, of the four caucus leaders. But the appointed commission chair was done by a Republican-controlled state Supreme Court, correct?
That's right. But this time, unlike last decade, they'll face a Democratic governor in Governor Tom Wolf, who can give an up or down vote on that bill and veto it if he doesn't like the map.
Right. We're talking about divvying up a state among congressional districts, more than 12.5 million Pennsylvanians. How much effort, though, goes into this process?
That's a good question, Kevin. You know, traditionally, this has been done largely in secret with no or little transparency. Last decade, in 2011, was the first time that the Legislative Reapportionment Commission had public meetings and solicited public input. At the end of the day, both the legislature and the commission presented the maps that they wanted. And then it's either left up to the governor in the congressional case, or ultimately the Supreme Court has the final say. And your listeners will probably remember in 2011, the Supreme Court ruled the first legislative map wasn't sufficient. It was illegal. And so they went back to the drawing board and drew a second map. And then, of course, your listeners will remember in 2017, the congressional map was litigated and overturned by the state Supreme Court. And we had, you know, new congressional lines from that. And so those things could happen again in any kind of order. It all depends on what these maps look like. But again, this has largely been done in secret in the past. And the legislators this time around haven't really divulged what their plan is for public hearings or for transparency.
Mm-hmm. You spoke for your reporting with the nonprofit Fair Districts PA, and that organization expressed concern that the delay in getting the census data could shroud the process in secrecy. Why do they think that?
Sure. So this census delay really cuts down on the amount of time lawmakers have to develop these maps and solicit public input. We have the deadline for filing your candidacy for the primaries in 2022 is coming up in March. And so if the data doesn't come until September, that really gives lawmakers a shortened amount of time to draw those maps and solicit input. And advocates like Fair Districts are worried that the legislators will kind of blame that delay and use it to say, you know, we don't have time for public input or for public meetings because we have to get these maps drawn in time. And so they're really worried about how this delay will impede upon constituents and voters' ability to really get involved in this process.
So, as you mentioned, in early 2018, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the congressional map that was drawn up in 2011 was unconstitutional. Republicans, how likely is it that there could be another legal battle this time around over the U.S. House map in Pennsylvania?
I think that's extremely likely. Like I said, litigation after redistricting is pretty common. So one scenario that could happen is if the maps that are produced this time around are litigated again and go to the Supreme Court, there could be a scenario in which as this is being litigated, the Supreme Court decides that the 2022 elections will have to be run under those old maps, that is the most recent ones from 2018. So we would be looking at an election in 2022 run under the old maps as lawmakers are continuing to either litigate or redraw the 2022 maps.
Marie Albiges is a reporter for Spotlight PA and Vote Beat. Marie, thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The pandemic, the illness, and maybe death of loved ones, and the isolation has impacted the mental health of many of us. The Pittsburgh nonprofit Steel Smiling tries to bridge the gap between Black community members and mental health support through education, advocacy, and awareness. Julius Boatwright is the founder and CEO of Steel Smiling. Thanks so much for joining us, Julius.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Julius, have you found that Blacks have just tried to plow through the daily stress of racial inequities in whatever form that takes? What are Black Americans doing to cope?
Well, one of the things that sticks out to me is that Black people are investing their time and energy into the healing process. What we found throughout the course of this pandemic and all of the racial injustices that have been happening since before the pandemic, but have been certainly exacerbated by the implications of the pandemic, is that Black folks are more willing to look for mental health support. They're more open to connect with their peers and share resources and different options for people to heal.
What are typically some of the barriers to seeking mental health treatment?
Well, there are quite a few barriers, particularly when it comes for Black people seeking and receiving adequate mental health treatment. So the biggest one that we try to focus our time and energy on is around access. So access could mean, do I have insurance that gives me the ability to access mental and behavioral health resources? And just because somebody does have insurance, they may have a copayment that they can't afford because at this point during the pandemic, they're either unemployed or underemployed. So whether your copay is $10, $20, or $30, or whatever the case may be, that could be a significant amount of money.
Julius, has the past year caused a tipping point? The disproportionate number of Black Americans dying from COVID, the demonstrations and protests locally and across the country against racial injustice. Has that added to the stress and maybe led to more Black Americans seeking some help?
Absolutely. So when we think about the impact and the implications of COVID-19, the racial injustices, and additionally, the compounding effects of all the other traumatic experiences that Black Americans were facing, we certainly saw an uptick in more Black folks saying, you know what, I'm now at a point where I absolutely need and want to prioritize my own mental health journey. So we saw that directly with our Black Mental Health Fund program. It was something that was non-existent prior to the pandemic and all of the racial injustices that came to light during the pandemic. And once that happened, folks, not just throughout the Pittsburgh region, but all across the country started to say, there's this organization that is focusing solely on Black mental health and healing. We need to make individual donations to them. We need to help them advocate for what they're doing, and we need to make sure as many Black people as possible know about the services and supports that they offer.
Steel Smiling's mental health fund, I mean, it's provided more than 1,000 hours for mental health treatment for Black people, not just Pittsburghers. What's it been like to see that growth?
The growth of the Black Mental Health Fund has been truly phenomenal and heartwarming. So what started out as something that I posted on my own personal social media outlets to let people know that Steel Smiling has a small amount. At that point, I believe it was about $5,000 of unrestricted support that we had to help Black folks offset costs related to mental health treatment. And to see what happened after we shared that message, we weren't actively fundraising, but hundreds and then turned into thousands of people all across the country started making donations. And we even had some support from various corporations and foundation partners, and it just turned into upwards of $100,000 for us to be able to help offset and pay for these costs related to Black people receiving mental health treatment. And so it's just been remarkable. We're continuing to offer those supports. We're reimagining that program. So in the spring, we will open it back up and it'll be a lot more intentional and refined and user-friendly for folks who are interested in receiving those services. So we're really looking to make that stronger and continue to add those supports well into 2021 and in the years after.
Your vision is to, quote, connect every Black person in Allegheny County to a positive mental health experience that improves their quality of life by 2030. Where are you toward meeting that goal?
Well, we are at the very beginning stages of that goal. So we are in the process of developing a deeper and more intentional and meaningful partnership with an organization called Neighborhood Allies. So they focus on community and economic development and really being intentional about identifying organizations, people, and places where equitable development can happen and thrive. So with them and some important partnerships, we've just been really building our model and our framework so that we can reverse engineer it and start to make some meaningful progress toward that goal. So we will be sure to keep folks updated on that progress as we continue to grow together.
Julius Boatwright is the founder and CEO of Steel Smiling. Julius, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's Yona Harvey has a rare distinction. She's an acclaimed poet who has also written for Marvel Comics. Her new collection is titled You Don't Have to Go to Mars for Love. She began a conversation with 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll by reading an excerpt from her poem, Sonnet District.
Stay woke, my ex whispered, easing into boxer shorts and skittering from bed sheets to back door, steeplechasing the furniture in less than 60 seconds. Turns out he'd been working for the Federal Bureau of Invisible Women, and his real name wasn't Tyrone, which I should have known because when was the last time I'd met a Tyrone in the black hole atmosphere of post and ish?
A number of the poems in the book have what some people have described as Afrofuturistic themes. And this poem, I think, partakes of that a little bit. There's a number of poems with the word district in the title, which gives a little bit of a science fiction feel to it. I'm wondering if you could talk about that aspect of the book.
I honestly feel it's not really my wheelhouse, but if it's a productive description for people, then I'm fine with it. I do love fantasy and sci-fi, and I wrote, you know, stories that took place in Wakanda. I think the thing that I connect to the most would be time bending and thinking about having conversations across time or simultaneously. You know, this notion that the past, the present, and the future are occurring all at once.
there's a technique that you use in a few of the poems where you're sort of incorporating two speakers at once, interpolating song lyrics, for instance, in between the literal words on a line, sometimes running verses side by side. What is it that you like about that technique?
I love the idea that my books aren't written by themselves on my own. It's not me who alone is fueling this work. I feel like I'm continuing in a tradition and a conversation with Black women, Black artists, you know, people across time. And so I think those voices are in my head often. And so it's important that those multiple voices show up on the page.
You mentioned earlier you're writing for Marvel Comics, The World of Wakanda, Black Panther and Crew with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Has writing for the comics influenced your poetry all, or vice versa?
Absolutely. I think writing for comics or writing comics sort of clarified some of the things that I was doing in poetry or thinking about. One of the most accessible things would be the line breaks and the images. So thinking about that relationship between, you know, image manipulation, time manipulation, when you break a line in a poem, and how that can be similar to panel transitions in comics and page turns in comics, the surprises, the reveals.
You talk about poetry and addressing sort of topical issues. We just had a really prominent example recently at the inauguration, Amanda Gorman, the youngest poet ever to read at the inauguration. I was wondering how you felt about her poem and also about the amount of discussion that it generated.
I was very excited that a person so young would take on that role. And I was actually interested, too, in people's responses to her. I think it's great anytime that poetry gets that attention, because I think so often the narrative in poetry is that not enough people read it. And I thought she did a fabulous job.
In addition to talking about what an event like that can do for poetry, what ways do you think that poetry can help us process the world around us?
I think poetry's in its brevity and its portability can help us take something that's so large and seemingly overwhelming and make it more manageable, make it more bite-sized, you know, felt in a different way. I think we're all overwhelmed by so much right about now. So I think poetry has a way of reducing that a little bit.
That was Jonah Harvey talking with WESA's Bill O'Driscoll about her new poetry collection, You Don't Have to Go to Mars for Love. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.